What's behind the rise of populism? At least part of the story is the economic disruption that America has experienced, especially in rural areas. Arlie Russell Hochschild tells the story in her new book, Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right, which is a follow-up to her 2016 book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, which was a New York Times bestseller and finalist for the National Book Award. Arlie is Professor Emerita of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of 10 books. Here she is with five big ideas from her latest.
Hi, I'm Arlie Hochschild, a writer, a sociologist, and most recently the author of Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right. To research this book over 7 years, I came to know people in the small towns and hollers of a coal mining region of eastern Kentucky in Appalachia. On the electoral map, it's Kentucky 5, the whitest and second poorest congressional district in America. Once the home of Roosevelt, Kennedy, and Bill Clinton Democrats, in the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, the region went 80% for Donald Trump, and I wondered why. The question seemed important to me on a bunch of grounds. What was happening in Kentucky 5 seemed to be occurring, and especially rapidly, among white Americans without BA degrees, the largest race education sector in the country, making up 48% of all Americans age 25 on up. It seemed a trend in motion elsewhere in the world, too. Finally, it seemed important in light of the upcoming close and highly consequential 2024 election. As the proverb goes, without wood, the fire goes out. So the question was, what in the current moment is that wood fueling today's political fire? And the most important in this book, do we have the right pair of glasses on, the right perspective to see and understand that wood when we encounter it? For all the ink spilled on the political crisis we're in, I didn't see a carefully worked out invitation to a perspective that would help. In particular, I came to focus on the basic importance of pride and shame. In speaking with a range of people, from a recovering heroin addict to a MAGA pro-solar entrepreneur, I heard unfolding stories that reflected to me the powerful role hidden in plain sight of loss, shame, and pride. Here are five key takeaways on just how larger economic and social circumstances impact people's sensed position in what I call a pride economy, and how that impacts the emotional ore, as I call it, that politicians mine and try to shape. So, what are these key takeaways? First, since the 1990s, whites without college degrees have been losing ground in income, property, and social well-being. The economist Raj Chetty has found that in the last three decades, incomes of white Americans with college degrees and Black Americans without them rose. But at the same time, income of non-college whites dropped, and their lives worsened in other ways too. White Americans without college degrees were less likely to report being in good health and more likely to say they live alone. Deaths of despair, including drug overdoses, alcohol-related liver disease, and suicide, have risen fastest among non-college whites, especially men. Backing up in time and looking at the nation's political geography across some post-70s America, globalization has created economic winners and losers. The blue states have largely been the winners, hosting global tech centers like Silicon Valley and Seattle, enjoying faster growth, higher income, and greater opportunity. Red states, on the other hand, have been the losers, suffering slower growth or decline, lower wages, and less opportunity. The 2008 recession, COVID, and climate volatility also hit red states harder than blue ones. These extra hits only heightened anxiety among those in regions like Pike County. Economics is basic, but pride and shame emerge, I show, as a powerful force, all their own. A second basic takeaway is pride and the culture of pride. In poorer, low opportunity red states, there are more Republicans who subscribe to what I call bootstrap pride. One man told me, if I succeed, that's me that got me that success because I worked harder. But if I fail, well, that's me too. So when the price of coal declines or renewables grow cheaper, factors beyond any individual's effort, such a man becomes vulnerable to shame, what we could call structural shame. If we put together a person's economic circumstances and his or her regional culture of pride, a painful paradox emerges. On one hand, a college-educated white-collar worker in a blue state city, however hard he is working, is more likely to say something like, demand for my skill is going down, or competition in my field is rising, or I have less chance of success because of my gender, race, or class. We could call it circumstance-sensitive pride. While nearly all of us fall somewhere between these two extreme types of bootstrap pride and circumstance pride, it's important backdrop to the unfolding story of that wood that lights a political fire. A third takeaway is that pride and shame are emotional bait. Shame, the pain of it, the fear of it, anger about it, can become powerful bait to a politician. If an aspiring leader can acknowledge and even absolve his potential followers' shame, he wins their personal identification and vote. Donald Trump has demonstrated this better than any public figure in recent memory. For again and again, he offers his supporters what I think of as an anti-shame ritual. The ritual is made up of five moments. In moment one, Trump says something transgressive, like all immigrants poison the blood of America. In moment two, the punditry, the mainstream press, and commentators shame Trump, saying something along the lines, you can't say that, we're an immigrant-based society. In moment three, Trump poses himself as the victim of punditry. See how they're persecuting me. In moment four, Trump roars back against the shamers. And from there, he slides into moment five, threats of punishment and full-scale retribution. Particularly in moments four and five, he offers his supporters an emotional release from their own shame, even as it is instantly transformed into blame, directed at a wide and familiar array of enemies. Democrats, liberals, the press, these people he has called enemies of the people, the deep state, and dozens of particular individuals and races, Muslims and blacks, for example, aroused to take revenge against those Trump calls his betrayers. Confusion disappears into clarity, flexibility into fixity, openness into closure, and defiance into submission to a leader under the guise of a commitment to democracy. As a fourth takeaway, calling for a good bully and fearing a tyrant, not fearing a tyrant. In my 2016 book, Strangers in Their Own Land, I spent years getting to know Tea Party members in Louisiana and offered a way of visualing how they imagined their situation, which I called a deep story. There are conservative deep stories and liberal deep stories. But a person in a conservative deep story feels this. He's facing a long line of Americans waiting for access to the American dream. He, let's imagine he, focuses on those ahead of him in line, not the greater number of those behind. Then he spots people he imagines as line cutters, women, blacks, immigrants, refugees, who seem to him unfairly favored by a liberal president, let's say Obama, over the regulars waiting in line. A Trump voter I describe in the new book had read my previous book, Strangers in Their Own Land, and revised this right-wing deep story. We're patiently waiting in line for the American dream, but we see a bully in line bossing us around, a bad bully. Then we see a second good bully bossing around the bad bully. We know he's self-centered, even mean, but he's our good bully. But could the right-wing good bully rip up the rules of democracy? I wondered. I'd like others, I wondered this. Trump has refused to accept his 2020 election loss, joked about dispensing with elections, proposed to alter the U.S. Constitution, and celebrated men jailed for violently breaking into the Capitol on January 6th. According to a Pew poll, some 20% of Americans, disproportionately from the right, agree that it's more important for the United States to have a strong leader than a democracy. I try to illuminate the emotional core of a national injury, but I imagine every one of my readers as potential healers. To heal and move forward, we must first understand the injury of shame and the powerful appeal of pride, and feel motivated to do so by daring to acknowledge the possible danger to our system of government. As we get to work, we need to hold in mind the current state of the American mind. The average American voter is more moderate in view than his or her leaders. And the vast majority of Americans value democracy. At the same time, many of each party hold exaggerated, even outlandish views about the beliefs and identity of those in the opposite party. Interestingly, liberal Democrats are more likely than conservative Republicans to cut off contact at the first sign of difference in political opinion. At the same time, poignantly for conservatives, personal contact makes more of a difference in their degree of tolerance for the other side. With care and thought and a new understanding of shame and pride, we can build an empathy bridge across differing groups who prize democracy and begin to communicate effectively even if we don't agree. Instead of gathering wood that would set the nation aflame, the underlying idea in Stolen Pride is to repurpose that wood to build a more just, cohesive nation.
Thank you, Arlie. That was Arlie Russell Hochschild with five big ideas from Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.